The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. This morning, I'm going to talk about finding faith in ourselves to spiritually change. I remember many years ago, I was talking to my mother, and she said to me, you know, people don't really change a whole lot, especially for the good. And I went, okay, but I believed her. Some part of me said, maybe that's true, because she said it was such a motherly authority that I didn't really question that. But now that I've come to a religious life, a different way of living than she does, I don't agree with her. I no longer feel that so. And I can see, I look around, and there's so many references to people changing in our tradition. And probably true religious people do change. There's something there that allows us to change. I think of Kazon, who had a real problem with temper. He was a very gifted young man, became a monk, and thought he was pretty good. He thought he was pretty wonderful. And he also had an accompanying temperament that made him pretty awful sometimes, too. But he did. He was able to see the harm that he was causing himself and others, and was able to change. And did, according to what we know, he was able to set aside that anger, and became a very, very compassionate person. And we have lots of other accounts of people that did change, and it's not just in our 2,500-year tradition, but also within our community. I feel like I have seen over the years monks change and lay people change too. And we're not talking about changes that are dramatic necessarily, but they are changes, and they're evident, and they're very nice. It's wonderful and encouraging to see that. So how can we change spiritually ourselves in our time? There's a lot of things going on in the world right now that are tough, difficult. And sometimes it can be a little despairing what's going on with the global change, you know, this current attack in Paris, France, of the ISIS terrorists. You know, that's not positive stuff. That's tough. It's really tough. And it may seem like, how can we do this impossible task of changing in a world that has a lot of difficult situations? So I thought I would offer some, hopefully, words of encouragement to all of us, including myself. And one thing that I realized is that in our spiritual practice, how well we are supported. We don't take credit for that. And that's what I mean by that is we have a lot of teachings of the Buddha. We have, believe it or not, we have each other, which even though it's not, it may not seem like it can be all that great sometimes, really and truly, if you think about what we're all trying to do, it's amazing. We're all trying to go in the same direction together. And just that recognition is supportive, because that's not really true, you can say, for too many groups of people that are going into change in a good direction together, trying their very best. Also, we have places like Shasta Abbey. There are places that you can actually come to that can offer you support for your practice. And these things are all kind of obvious, but it's just not... what they're offering is for us to have more chances of actually changing within ourselves. And then there's also just our own practice itself. Sometimes, not all the time, but some simple, unexpected moment will arise and it can be joyful, naturally joyful. And it's nothing that is contrived or manipulated, or there's no formula for finding that joyful moment. But the heart has these little openings that are just helpful, and it's just pure joy. And there's nothing you can do with them, because in a moment, guess what? They're gone. But those moments do exist, and I do believe that we all know about those moments, and they encourage us in our practice to carry on. So the moments that arise that are joyful are just that, they're moments, they come and go. Also within those moments are other things, like lots of other things that arise in the moment. It can be doubt, stillness, grief, confusion, joy, boundless space, darkness, despair, light, understanding, peace, anger. All those things come to us are in the moments that we know so very well. This is life, all this stuff. So I was thinking of taking an example of doubt. Let's see, where is it? Find it. Doubt that we can't do the practice. Doubt that there could not possibly be within us something like the Buddha nature, or that it is helpful to how we lead our lives. But this is what I'm looking at, doubt. What happens when something like doubt or grief arises? In my mind, what it's calling for is a way to redefine our views. The doubt is painful, and it is not something that really is particularly helpful. But what I see with that is that it is calling out for us to redefine the way we view the world. And that may seem like something that's impossible, but it just isn't. It's something that we do as Buddhists, we aspire to, and that it is our way. And an image I remember years ago was of a monk sitting in meditation with rose-colored glasses. So that gives you a clue, rose-colored glasses. So things were a little bit shaded in the rose-colored realm of hue. And also, the glasses were broken. In other words, it was like safety glass. If you've ever seen an auto accident, it's like the glass stays on the windshield, but it's all together, but all these little pieces. So in other words, the monk was sitting there with these rose-colored glasses that had been broken. But the key there is that he was still sitting there. Why? Because doubt was calling him to find another view. He was willing to find out if there was another view. Again, reading the scriptures, listening to other people, there is support for maybe that there are other views besides the one that we get so engrossed in and think that are so totally all that there is. I question that. Is that all that there is? And once we can recognize within ourselves that we have doubt, that's a good first step. The next step is the willingness to sit still within that doubt. And this is where it gets a little, I don't know, uncomfortable. because we're not trying to push it away, we're not trying to grab onto it, but sit with faith that that doubt is actually okay. That within that doubt, you can sit still in the muddle-headedness, and it's okay, because that's not the whole picture. To allow the doubt just to simply be. And what happens with that is interesting, because given enough time, we see that that doubt, one, isn't all that it's mocked up to be, and that, two, we don't have to necessarily be the ones that are controlled by, say, the doubt. Because with meditation practice and the things that we bring to meditation, to our daily lives, we can find that there is something else besides the doubt. And oftentimes, if you can sit still within that judgment, without that judgment, you might just see a different view. In fact, I'm pretty sure you will. So we're not stuck. And we have a lot of tools in our practice, of course, to help us find a little bit more space in our lives in the moment. And I think the laity, you have all been studying, the lay residents have been studying the paramitas lately. And so I thought I'd just list them because you've been studying them, know a little bit more about them. And the paramitas are tools that we can use for helping ourselves to lessen harm for ourselves and others through our body, speech, and mind. And they are giving, keeping the precepts, patience, vigor, meditation, and wisdom. And there's some other paramitas that are sometimes included. And they're skillful means, commitment, strength, and knowledge, and understanding. And these are the tools that we can use to help us in our training and in our meditation practice by aspiring to be, say, more mindful or more patient. If we can aspire to be that way, then we can, by that aspiration, bring that into the moment. Naturally, it comes into the moment. It can be part of our lives. It can be start to be more than just a word or a concept, but it actually can help us in our daily life. I found a quote that I keep coming back to that says a lot to me, and so I wanted to share it with you. If we put the paramitas in practice, then we are bringing, as best we can, the paramita practice of skillful means, which encompasses all of the other paramita practices, because skillful means is what we do in the moment, doing the best we can with what we have, making an action or a word speaking that we can bring to the moment. And this is what it says, that the skillful means is able to generate in worldliness the ultimate form of pure faith. This is because it explains the path of supremely sublime goodness. Let me just read that again. Skillful means is able to generate in worldliness the ultimate form of pure faith by sitting still, not knowing what to do, to say, I'm going to be open to receive. Maybe that there's another view. Just maybe. And maybe it's better. This is because that way of living, of bringing to the moment in meditation, it explains the path of supremely sublime goodness. Well, that's quite a statement. But what I find with that is that given enough time, for one thing, why would we do this practice if we didn't have some reward or some motivation to keep doing it? And I think over time, if you had an interview with people that practice for a while, that there's something that is with the practice that is good. It's not something you could grab hold of. It's not something you can conceptualize. It's something much, much bigger than we are. But it is. It's true. It helps us out. It manifests itself. What's our task is to be in the moment as best we can with whatever stuff is coming up, the joy, the grief, whatever, being still with that, and being open at that moment to receive who knows what. And that's the scary part. You don't know what. It's really putting yourself into an unknown big time. And that's the pure faith that quote was talking about. That's where we can affect change in our lives, is right in that space there. So this is going to be a short talk, but that's all right. What I'm going to do is read a story that I think some of you have heard already, but I just keep coming back to it. I like it. And it's a story from a book that I was reading about mindful work. And this is a story of compassion in a conflict situation. Sherry Maples came to mindfulness the way so many of us do. She was in pain. A police officer in Madison, Wisconsin, Maples tweaked her back while pulling a stolen moped out of the trunk of her squad car and landed in the chiropractor's office. There on the waiting room table was a book about mindfulness by Thich Nhat Hanh. A year before this moment, in 1991, she wouldn't have bothered to read the first page. But she had recently gotten sober and in the process had become a little more receptive to spirituality. Now with 3 weeks of leave mandated so her back could heal, Maples went all in, signing up for a nearby retreat with some of Thich Nhat Hanh's monks and nuns. Maples arrived at the retreat skeptical that other participants would understand her, given that she was a cop. When she was asked to take the 5 mindfulness trainings, the first of which is reverence for life, Maples said she couldn't do it. Her job, she explained to one of the nuns, could require her to kill. "Who else would we want to carry a gun except someone who is mindful?" The nun responded, "Skillful means." And sometimes she, you know, who knows if she was thinking about that ahead of time, but it just pops out that skillful means is not a manipulated type of things. Anyway, "So who else would we want to carry a gun except someone who is mindful?" the nun responded. That moment served as a small opening for Maples. She no longer did her identity as an officer of the law preclude her having a much more expansive, compassionate side to her being as well. Since that retreat, she has been a committed practitioner. The first way Maples began bringing mindfulness to work was by checking her intentions each time she responded to a call. Instead of letting each call over the radio trigger an amygdala hijack, pumping her up with adrenaline as she prepared to confront a potentially dangerous situation, she took a mindful pause. And this is a true story, by the way. She cultivated a sense of service and remembered that her role was to create a situation that minimized harm. With that wholesomeness and intention in place, she would be on her way to the crime scene, committed not only to defusing a potentially dangerous situation, but also to helping those in need. Over the years, this saved lives. Maples was more prudent in her reactions. "I never did have to shoot anybody, even in situations where by policy I could have," she said. "Carrying a gun can be an act of love when armed with mindfulness." The next step came as she became more mindful of how she was doing in the wake of intense calls. Instead of simply rushing back onto the street, succumbing to the peer pressure that drives cops to handle as many calls as possible, she would take her time. She would reflect on what had just transpired and with self-awareness evaluate her own performance on the job. Had she responded skillfully, how could she have improved her behavior? If she was rattled or exhausted, she gave herself room to recover. Maples was practicing self-compassion too. Back at the station, Maples worked to curb gossip, which was rampant among the officers. She understood that negative speech was corrosive, weakening the ties that bound the police force together, and ultimately leading to officers who were less unified in their mission to protect the public. The popularity contest at the station was also among the biggest of the job stressors, and Maples knew that removing some of that anxiety from the workplace could only help. She even began speaking up against injustice, though it was at time at her own peril. When peers made a wisecrack laced with sexism or racism, Maples found a way to gently push back. Later in her career, as she began to train new recruits, she added some mindfulness practices to their regimen. In one exercise, she would have them write value reflections, prodding them to explore their own compassion, even if it was latent. I wanted them to get in touch with the values in their lives that were most important, she said. Bringing compassion to work gave Maples a new career of sorts. It turned policing from something Maples did, a job that defined her, into a process she participated in where she could affect some positive change in the world. It took her role as a cop from a hard-edged vocation fraught with peril into an opportunity to help practice compassion and heal the people in her community. It's not like I didn't make an arrest or didn't have to use force, she said. I always was going to protect myself and the person I'm arresting from unconscious habit energy. But I went about it with a different intention, and it made a difference. So I thought, I've read that. I said, oh, you know, I've read this so many times, and I thought, you know, I've done that. But it just seems like it still has something to offer about, this is a real-life story, not an easy situation. But she was willing, the time was just right for her to pick that up, and not just say, oh, mindfulness, a retreat, but to make it, to integrate it into her life so much so that she could make a difference. And I think that's really encouraging because we all have made a difference already in our own lives and we can continue to do that. And as we put the teachings into practice and open up and receive that which is already there for us, then we too can affect change in our lives and we can make a difference as well. Thank you.